The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org. On Tuesday, the Independent Investigations Office of BC released a report simply titled January 5th, 2021, Vancouver, Death, 2021-006. In it, the office's chief civilian director, Ronald J. McDonald, QC, declared that the shooting death of a Filipino man, Chester, by two Vancouver police officers was, quote, justified, necessary, and proportionate. Yesterday, I spoke with Vince Tao, community organizer with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, or VANDU, about the report. Hello, Vince, and welcome back to The Pulse.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Just a couple of days ago, the Independent Investigations Office, the people who look into police shootings, cleared a couple of Vancouver police officers in the shooting death of a distressed man back in January. Can you take us back to that time and just sort of quickly remind us what happened on that day?
So it's January 5th, if I recall right. That's in the morning. Before the sun comes up around 5 a.m., a man naked on the streets outside Grace Mansion, run by the Salvation Army on Hastings and Princess, is intercepted by the police. He is completely naked. He is swinging a large metal object, and he's in distress. He's saying that he wants to die, and he's crying. He's seen earlier running into a wall, clearly disoriented. Police arrive on the scene, and within 5 seconds, they fire 5 bullets into his chest, and he's dead. And that's the story. We wouldn't have been... This type of killing happens all the time on the Downtown East Side. We are thankful that a resident, a neighbor in the Downtown East Side was able to capture the killing from his SRO on his phone and leaked that video before it was seized by the police to the news. And that's how, the rest of us in the Downtown East Side and VANDU were able to recreate the events. And that's exactly what we did. So that morning, so I work at a place called the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. It was a Tuesday morning. We go in, we open up at 9 a.m. every morning, and some of our members start talking about, hey, did you hear about the man killed by police just down the street? We're at Hastings and Dunleavy, only a couple of blocks away. And so we start to investigate. We have our, we've had weekly Tuesday meetings, 2 o'clock, education in action for 20 plus years. That day we talk about the killing. And immediately, people are outraged because we know that this is a user. This is one of us, as a member. He was, a resident of Grace Mansions, which is a recovery house. And he was seen as being intoxicated either on drugs or alcohol. And the police, as such, murdered him in cold blood. And so our membership decided, we resolved ourselves that day to investigate, to find out who this man was, to make sure that he wouldn't die and disappear, right, without a name. And that we would investigate, we'd find his family, we'd make sure that, not one more life is taken by the police and disappear right from the streets. And so for the next 2 weeks, we were planning a memorial march. And in that time, we were able to, through our contacts on the street, on Hastings, in the drug user network that VANDU is at the center of, we were able to find out his name. His name was Chester. He was a Filipino man. He was a construction worker. He had friends. He had family. We were able to find his family and contact them, talk to them. We were able to find some of his friends, learn a bit about his life. He had just bought a car. He was very proud of it. He would call his mother quite often, probably more than I call my mother. And he was on his way to recovery, but again, everyone slips up. It happens, it's a tough world. And something triggered him. And in the days leading up, this is what we'd heard. He was not acting right. He was feeling unwell in days leading up to this incident. Yet, as many of these recovery houses go, many of the housing in the Downtown East Side goes, very isolating, right? And services, as much as people, places like Salvation Army, especially, it relies on this, abstinence model of recovery. And again, that puts a lot of pressure on individuals, again, either to abstain from, you know, necessary use of medicine or hide it, right? Which again, it puts a lot of pressure on individuals, you know, trying to recover or trying to even stay in a place, stabilize their lives. And so in the days leading up to the incident, he was not feeling well, but yet there was no intervention. And as such, yeah, he had a break. He, you know, had a mental health incident, as we call it. Yet again, the police showed up and fired 5 bullets into his chest within 5 seconds of seeing him. You know, we're talking here today because it's the IOO, the Independent Investigations Office, as they call themselves, of BC, released a report just 2 days ago, you know, with their findings on why it was justified to kill Chester. And you know, this is, we knew this way back in January, right? It was a foregone conclusion, as you know, we chatted about earlier. We knew that they were going to absolve these cops from killing him. Of course they were, right? And why? Because he's a drug user. He's a racialized man. He's a poor person. This is a life that was expendable, right? If you read the report, they don't even name him. Everyone knows his name because of our investigation at Vandu. Yet, he's the quote-unquote affected person, or AP. Affected by murder, yes. And, right, it's a horror to read this report. It really is. Because you see, you know, first of all, this is beside the point. The investigator's name is Ronald McDonald, and he uses this language of like, oh, they had no choice. They had no choice. The police officers had no choice but to use lethal force immediately as they saw this man because he was, you know, on drugs, right? He was on drugs. He was like, you know, waving a stick around. You know, there's all this, like, you know, they talk about, oh, he's wielding a sword. It could have done a lot of damage. It's clearly he's going to kill someone. The thing is, I've watched the footage, right? And this is the thing. I've been able to, you know, through our investigation, obtain the full footage of the killing, right? But also the time leading up to it. There's at least an hour that elapses where Chester is alone on the streets, naked. He's running around. He's running into a wall, running into a door. Right? And nothing is done. But he's also not harming anyone. There are people walking by. There are bystanders walking by. They steer clear, right? But still, this man is just having a bad time. He's having a crisis. And nothing is done. And no one's around. None of the staff are around for some reason. And obviously, there's no other police that show up, even though they should be, you know, keeping the peace, so-called. Yet, they arrive on scene and they justify again this murder by saying, oh, he could have hurt someone. He could have hurt someone else. He could have hurt a bystander if the police did nothing. The only reason that Chester started to lunge, right, let's say, at the officers is because they arrived on scene with their guns out, right? And for me, again, you try to understand the situation. This man is he's in a crisis, right? And he sees two cops, right? Again, people that, you know, folks on the downtown east side, drug users, police, you know, poor people, they do not have a very, you know, good track record with police interaction, let's say. And so he sees the cops, and he starts to charge towards them. Again, he's completely naked, and he's holding, like, a piece of metal. And again, you know, this is all justified ex post facto in Ronald McDonald's report of the murder, that the police, again, had no choice. They had no choice but to murder this man in cold blood. And for me, I'm actually at a loss for words, right? Because again, I'm not surprised at this result. I'm still, you know, I read this thing 2 days ago, and I couldn't stop myself from just tearing up and just remembering how our members at Vandu, drug users, poor people in downtown East Side, are not treated as human, right? This is what it all comes down to. That's the first thing that Ronald McDonald says in his report, is like he was on drugs or intoxicated. At that point, you know that this man is fated to die, that he will be murdered by the police, right? We've seen this time.
If you don't mind my interrupting, I mean, right. I just read the report myself a couple of hours ago, and I was wondering, well, how did they know that he was on drugs? They said he was acting in a manner to suggest he was on drugs or alcohol, but how, right. You know, we don't even know that maybe he was having some sort of psychotic episode or something like that. At least it seems to this layman's eyes. Do you suppose that's a possibility?
It is curious. How could they have, you know, known that he was on drugs or intoxicated ahead of that murder, right? And ahead of them, you know, arriving on scene. You can, I guess, surmise, because he's a resident of the Grace Mansions. But again, this, and I think you bring up a good point here, right? There's a very thin line between a mental health crisis and someone relapsing. Again, and oftentimes these are overlapping phenomena, right? And, you know, if you read over the report, right, there's no mention of, let's say, car 86, right? The car, you know, this VPD and the Vancouver Police Department and Vancouver Coastal Health, they have a partnership where they send up this car, you know, to intercept in moments where there's like a mental health crisis. This car was not called, right? Instead, it was two officers, which, strangely enough, you know, again, this is important to note. Because a lot of the questions coming out after this murder was, why didn't they use less than lethal force? Why didn't they use a taser, a beanbag, so on and so forth? Because the officers, according to the IO, just didn't have it on them, right? And this, again, begs the question, like, why did they show up? They didn't send the mental health support car, right? Because clearly this guy, he was screaming, "I want to die," right? He's suicidal, or at least he's saying, you know, he's claiming that he's suicidal. Like, this is a moment where a mental health worker should be on site, right? Yet, you know, instead they send two cops armed with nothing but lethal weapons, with guns, you know, loaded guns, onto the scene. And again, within 5 seconds, he's dead, right? This is a, you know, there's a big question here around how drug users and people with mental health issues are treated on the downtown east side as enemy combatants immediately. And their lives are expendable, right? I hate to retread this, but it's like, you know, we said this months ago. We knew that this was going to happen because he was a member of the downtown east side community. And again, he was also a racialized man. And a man that, you know, frankly, you know, in conversation, a lot of folks thought he was Native, right, from the way he looked, right? And so there's probably these overlapping forms of stigma that led to, again, this. And, I, you know, the funny thing is about this investigation is that the two officers, right, SO1, SO2, whatever, as they're listed in the investigation, refused to be interviewed, right? Their statements were collected and used for the investigation, but they didn't want to be talked to.
Yeah, right. Something about the reports that they wrote for the VPD were entered in as evidence. And I found it curious, too, reading the report, is that they said that they collected testimonies from paramedics and other bystanders and whatnot. There's not one word mentioned about what those people said. All we read are just Ronald McDonald's conclusions based, it seemed to me, just again as a layperson reading it, on the video evidence. They saw him approach the cops and the cops fired, and McDonald says, "Well, that seems fine enough to me. I guess they did exactly what they're supposed to do." I don't know. I'm expressing opinion, which I'm not supposed to do as a journalist, but it just seemed to be like a pretty thin report.
The report is 4 pages long.
Yeah, right? I know.
It's 4 pages long, and it literally ends, again, with him saying that they had no choice, right? But there are many choices to be made, right, in this situation. I'm sorry, right?
Well, and, like, yeah, that's what I want to ask. And in your opinion, in your experience, you know, what could have been done to help de-escalate the situation? I'm not that familiar with working with people with mental health crises or addiction issues, so I really have no idea what could have been done. Can you tell us?
I think it's always key in one of these these murders to despectacularize what's happening, right? Because because we're leading up, we know that this man was, you know, in a recovery house. He was having trouble, you know, days leading up to this incident, right, to his death, to his murder. Yet not, there was no support for him, right? And again, you know, these are conditions created by, you know, abstinence-based thinking, like drug prohibition law and thinking in the downtown east side. That leads up to this moment, again, creates all this pressure on this individual that he has a crisis, right? And then again, he's left. He's like, it's in the morning, and there should be staff on site. Yet no one intervenes. He's alone on the street. We know that he has friends in the neighborhood, right? But yet he's alone because it's early in the morning. And eventually, yeah, the police, they just show up. He sees the police. I'm sure that he's scared. He's shocked by the presence of police, right? Again, as a drug user, as a poor person, as a racialized person, especially when you're in a mental health crisis, the presence, the presence of police is very, yeah, it's not good, right? And as such, they have no choice because he starts to walk towards them, that they have to kill him immediately. So leading up to, there's so many moments there in which this could have been prevented. One, if he had the right support, right, in his housing, if he had like decent housing at all, right? If he had a mental health worker check in on him, if he had, let's say if his friends were called rather than the police, right? This is a model that we talk about a lot at Vandu about, how else can we intervene in crisis? Because crisis does happen. Like we are not above understanding that there is violence, there's conflict on the Downtown East Side. But we always try to imagine like what else could we do besides call the police, which would only escalate the situation into further violence and clearly death. Is that we would want to call people that we know, right? Is that the Downtown East Side, unlike any other neighborhood, unlike any other neighborhood in Vancouver, possibly in Canada, is that there's people, everyone knows each other, right? There's a dense network of survival, right, and support that's necessary to live in the Downtown East Side. And you walk by, on the street, everyone knows each other's names. And there's a reason for that. Again, it's because we have to support each other because the state has, the government has left people to die there. And so we need to build these like intensely strong bonds in the neighborhood, right? And so why can't, instead of calling the police, we call a friend, right? Call a support worker, call someone in between those two things, right? Because, again, Chester had a bunch of buddies in the neighborhood, right? But they weren't able to, show up at 4 a.m. because they didn't know what was happening. But what if, again, if we stretch the imagination and say, rather than have two people drive up in, cars with blaring lights, right, with guns drawn, and have 5 seconds to respond to that, you had your friend show up, right? Someone that you know, someone that you trust. I think it's very, very much possible and convincing to believe that the situation would not have turned out that way, right? And again, and the final choice is down with the police, right? It's like really with those two officers that refused, I think very, very evocative that they didn't choose to be talked to about this, right? Why did they fire so quickly, right? Why is it they saw this person again who's naked, right? He was racialized. They probably assumed he was a drug user. He probably assumed he was an unhoused person. There's something in there, right? In the way that these police people are trained, right, to understand the Downtown East Side population, again, as enemy combatants, right? That's what the VPD are here for, is to make invisible and to suppress and contain the Downtown East Side, right? It's poor residents, unhoused people, drug users. That is their raison d'etre. Like, that's why they exist, right? And we know this. It's been decades of this. Their conduct, what they do, their operations, street sweeps, everything they do, attacking unhoused people, attacking drug users, shaking people down, beating up, indigenous folks. That's all they do in the Downtown East Side. And of course, they come into this and they see the situation. They make a split second decision. This guy's got to die, right? And of course, Ronald McDonald's like, exactly. He has to die. And that's it. And they think that this is like a good conclusion. It's actually a farce, right? It's an absolute farce that they dared to even produce this report.
That suggests the question then, they call themselves the Independent Investigations Office. Given the relationship the VPD has with the neighborhood, do you think that that's what their role is, to be independent and to investigate? Or is it more just to be there as to justify the actions of the police?
The latter, completely, right? James, I think we both know this, is that there's nothing independent about the IOM. It's all ex-cops that fill the seats there. But beyond that is that the development of the IO is actually quite interesting, right? Like, I don't know the details about this, but you can imagine, you read back in the day, for instance, if you revisit something like the murder of Fred Hampton, like the Black Panther leader, prior to the IO, because there's similar institutions in the U.S. Prior to the existence of these investigation offices, sometimes the police would just leave the body for a while, right? They just leave because they're like, oh, we just killed someone, we just walk away from it. And then the IOO, was developed to actually bureaucratize this investigation process, because prior to that, the community could do its own investigation. Right, the police would just leave the body because they don't care about a poor person's life, racialized person's life. They just leave the body and walk away. But prior to with the IOO, now everything is sealed, right? Which is why you even read this report, even after we were able to get it into the news. You should read every major news source in Vancouver. We were able to get Chester's name out there. Still, they call him the AP, right? And it's because they would like to seal this all up. That's exactly what happens when someone dies in police custody or dies because of police violence. The investigations office comes in to clean up the scene, right? To just pour bleach everywhere and lock up all the facts, requisition or seize all the evidence and create their own narrative, right? Unfortunately, this is not the only police death that we've encountered in the Downtown East Side this year. On May 1st, someone named Wendy was taken in at 9 a.m. on May 1st. She was picked up on Powell Street right by Oppenheimer Park. Within 3 hours, we know that 3 hours later, at noon, she was found dead in her holding cell, right, in VPD custody. She was an Indigenous woman. She was a drug user. She's known in the community, known as a drug user. She was dead. And the thing is, it's impossible to find any facts about this. Again, there's one just like, very, you know, there's like a short news clip about it. Again, they don't name her. We had to find out her name, again, through an investigation. But this is what the IOO does. They cover the murders up. That's what they do, right? And they justify ex post facto. Again, a foregone conclusion about why the police did what they were supposed to do. Not in any recent history have they ever ruled otherwise. I'm not sure. Maybe I need to do a bit more research. But again, this is a completely unaccountable institution. It's a farce that they call themselves independent. But it's, what's more of a travesty is the power they wield in being able to shape a narrative and, again, also disappear a person completely, right? They still refuse to name Chester, and he will not be named, right, in official police discourse, in the records, in public record. It was only because of the community investigation that we did at Vandu to make sure that this man would not disappear, and neither will Wendy, right? And we're going to keep doing this work. That's the thing. The police think that we're going to stop, that we're going to, the report's here. Oh, okay, we're done. Thank you very much. No, this is not over, right? We will make sure that there's justice for Chester, right? And we will make sure there's justice for Wendy and for every other drug user, for every other Downtown East Side resident, for every other unhoused person that's killed by the police. We're not going to stop. We're going to make it really hard for them to keep getting away with this. And hopefully, one day, they'll never do it again.
Well, it is really great work that you do down in the Downtown East Side, and I thank you very much for taking a few minutes to talk with me, Vince. Maybe just quickly before we go, I know there's a big event that you're planning that's going to be coming up next Tuesday, I think it is, on the 31st. Can you just quickly tell us what that's going to be all about?
Right, yes, that's International Overdose Awareness Day, or Overdose Day of Action. So we have been, recognizing this day for many years at Vandu, and it's a sad day because too many people die of overdose. But we also understand the drug war is a big one, and it's not just what affects our members, users, unhoused people on the Downtown East Side is not just the toxic supply. That is, of course, our focus. For our last few campaigns is for a safe supply of drugs. But we have always understood at Vandu that the pressures of the drug war are manifold. It's about housing. It's about social policy. It's about poverty. And obviously, it's about policing, right? And so, this day, next week, 31st, we'll be doing a march, memorial march from Vandu at 380 East Hastings. starting at 12:30. We march you to Oppenheimer Park to honor those who have died this year and, you know, in the last two decades of our existence at Xanadu. Those who have died have been, you know, whose lives have been taken away by this drug war, but also we will honor Chester. We will honor Wendy. Drug users, members, people in our community whose lives have been taken away by the police. And that's why shortly after the Memorial March, we are throwing a party, a big block party, right outside Xanadu, right on the 300 block of Hastings, and we're calling it Cop Free Day. We'll be having hot dogs, donuts, there'll be music, and we will also be giving out a clean, safe supply of heroin, methamphetamines, and powder cocaine to our members. So that's the 31st. Come on out, please, please.
Thanks again, Vince, for talking with me. It's really great to have you on the Pulse.
Yeah, no, thanks for calling me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk.
That was Vince Tao, community organizer with Xanadu. In January, The Pulse aired three episodes devoted to the shooting. You can listen to them on the Pulse podcast. On January 12th, we spoke with Meenakshi Mano of the Pivot Legal Society. Then on January 13th, we aired audio from the memorial service organized by Xanadu. And on January 14th, we spoke with Vince Tao. You can read the report from the Independent Investigations Office of BC, titled January 5th, 2021, Vancouver, Death, 2021-006, at the website iiobc.ca. CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.